Okay, so my name is Grace Helms Kotri, and I began working at ICPJ in January 2008. I actually had just finished my MSW program, my Master's in Social Work, locally here at U of M, and I was really excited to get a job. I was excited to be done with school, and...
Well, that's part of what I remember when you when we hired you, we weren't getting to know you for the first time. I remember being on a panel with you over, I think, at the Modern Languages Building about social action, and you were so active with campus organizing around Darfur. When we saw you as an applicant, it was like, well, first of all, we already knew you, which always helps, but what we wanted you to be doing professionally was the stuff you were already doing, not as part of your education, but on top of your formal education. So that for us was just this tremendous, like, okay, here we go.
That's funny. Yeah, I had forgotten that. But yeah, I did connect with you a few times ahead of time and had gone to a racial justice event and was already interested in the kind of work that ICPJ was doing. So I knew about the organization and was active in some racial justice stuff in the School of Social Work and some international social justice with the Darfur organization and others. And I wanted to do that kind of work. I wanted to do that. And I actually had fantasies about, you know, going to D.C. and doing international type work and, like, really wanting to be solving the world's problems. So, but I wanted to also stay local because I was married and we were living here in Ann Arbor. And logistically, it made a lot more sense for me to be looking locally. And I was worried I wouldn't find what I was looking for. So when I came across this ICPJ job opening, which fit perfectly in terms of schedule, being open starting in January, which is when I was ready, it felt like it was almost meant to be. And I, of course, I didn't know if I would be able to get the job. But once I interviewed, I felt so strongly like it was the right fit. And for me, when I entered the organization, I was not drawn to it for the interfaith part. And I was a little worried that I wouldn't get the international part and just thought, well, I think this will be a good fit anyway. I'm not sure why, but I had a good feeling. And then as I continued to work and explore and grow through my work at ICPJ, I learned what I now consider one of my personal mottos, one of them, which is the think globally, act locally. The idea that the world's most pressing issues are present absolutely on a smaller level in our communities, and that they're present even on a smaller level within our own individual lives and ourselves, and that the work we have to do to address these huge issues that feel unsolvable, I feel really strongly now and learned a lot about this through ICPJ, the work we have to do is right here. It's within ourselves. It's within our small communities. It's within our families. It's within our cities.
Can you give an example of that?
So for me, like with the work we're doing, I was doing work in social work school with Save Darfur, with issues in Africa, war and poverty and civil war, constant war, and the effects that it had on children and the effects that it had on all the people in that region. And I felt really connected to the people there, but that was so far away and there was so little. I felt somewhat powerless in that organization, even though I was co-leading it at the time and I felt so invested in it. There was a powerlessness about it being on the other side of the world and about my not actually knowing anybody from that area, and also a sense of, you know, kind of who am I to be? If I'm not really hearing their voices, it felt a little...
Inauthentic?
Maybe inauthentic, yeah. To be representing them to others and to be telling their stories. And even if it was to raise money for them or whatever it was for, it felt like it wasn't grounded maybe in some of the things I believe about social justice work and in about the people speaking for themselves. And it felt to me... So I did feel in that organization and in other work I had done before like the problem was out there. Like, there were problems out there, and I was going to help to solve them. And that always did feel a little inauthentic, a little bit off. And so the idea of working directly with my own prejudices through, you know, book groups or through discussion groups with people from different traditions or people from different backgrounds, reading articles and exploring more of my own contribution to social injustice, the way that I was perpetuating injustice without my without being conscious of that. That felt more real. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's true for me on a community level as well, in that when I'm able to actually sit down and have a conversation with a group of people of different faith traditions, and we're talking about, like with our Muslim movie series or scriptural reasoning, if we're talking about issues that are directly affecting them in our community where they are actually experiencing social injustice and being
perpetrated. So can you explain what those were?
Yeah, those events. Yeah. So those two events really stand out to me as being directly useful and timely. The events I'm talking about, I think we did them in my early years of being there, like 2008, 2009. And those events were, they were an effort to dispel the myths and stereotypes about Islam and about Muslims, especially in a time when Muslims were facing direct persecution throughout our country. It was an intentional effort to counter those, to counter that discrimination, to stand with people who were being persecuted on behalf, on the basis of their religion, as a group of interfaith individuals.
So what I remember, I'm remembering from the scriptural reasoning, like I remember we were with our work, partly that came out of our work around Israel-Palestine, and just feeling this immense roadblock of the level of distrust here in Ann Arbor was so intense. It was difficult to get people even to talk to each other. So we sort of took a step back and said, okay, let's talk about these issues. Let's talk about, and sometimes it was things that related directly to the conflict in Israel and Palestine, like how do you honor the neighbor, or food issues. And sometimes that, you know, food issues was a little bit, but it was still safe enough that people could come and they could learn together and they could explore together. And then one of our interns, Noor Ali, came up with the idea of the Muslim movie series. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was interesting for me with watching that, not just the movies, but the community that was there was, as you said, that the Muslim community at that time was, there was such a level of persecution and isolation. You know, on the one hand, it wasn't the Muslim community that needed to come to the movie series, but we had a tremendous turnout because what they saw was they saw that non-Muslims care about what's happening to Muslims. And they had it, and we were having it at, a lot of them were at Temple Beth Emma St. Clair's Episcopal Church, so that it was at a synagogue, I think meant something too. One of the things I liked about that is the film I remember most from that series is Allah
the
Made
funny
Me
one.
Funny.
Yes, right. He was a comedian. He was.
It was three Muslim stand-up. And that was, part of it was the diversity of the Muslim community too, because he had somebody from Pakistan and somebody from Palestine, and a white guy who's Muslim too. And so like you've got the diversity within the Muslim community, but like it wasn't the standard. The standard documentary feel. So it was a.
And people were laughing out loud, and there were children there. And there was, like, at one point, there were 80 people in the room for one of those showings. And it seemed like such a simple thing to do, to show a movie. Mm-hmm. But it was uniting in a time when there wasn't a lot of unity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so that stood out to me when I thought back about ways that expressed itself, the ways that I felt like we were taking direct action in our local community on issues that were international issues. They are issues that span the globe, but they were issues that were present for us, and we could personally affect change here on that. So ICBJ did teach me a lot about how to pursue social change locally, even with a global angle, a global spin.
And I think one of the other things I learn when I think about those is it's those relationship buildings. Just in the last year, we had the Muslim students killed in Chapel Hill. And there it was that same effort, you know, reaching out to the mosque, reaching out to the EMU Muslim Student Association, because it's a whole new community, right? There's such turnover in this community. So the constant work to reestablish those connections and to tell people who may be feeling alone that you're not alone, whether that's the Muslim community post Chapel Hill, whether it's the Jewish community post, you know, some of the Jewish targeting that happened in Europe this summer, this past year, whether it's the African-American community post-Ferguson, you know, that saying, that bringing together this diverse coalition of allies to say, we're here for each other, and when your community is being targeted, we're here for you, is really powerful for the communities that are getting it, and it's a, we're never done, right? We're never done. Okay, we've got the relationship with, you know, the Muslim community, check that box off, we're done. It's a constant, it needs constant attention, just like any relationship does.
It does, yeah. And ICPJ is, I think, unique in that it does that across the board. It responds in that way across the board for groups that are, you know, experiencing direct persecution. And, you know, year after year, it keeps coming up. But also doing preventative things. I mean, things not just reactively, but I think about one of the things that stands out to me, and I don't know that I was able to attend more than one of these, really, even as a staff person, but the Racial Justice Book Group to me, mm-hmm. that's been ongoing for, what, 8 years, more than that, maybe?
It's been a while,
long time.
Yeah.
That things like that allow deeper exploration of our own, you know, our own underlying prejudice and what we've been conditioned to believe in our own communities and our families, et cetera, to explore that so that we can be better people, not just better advocates for others, but that we can exist and embody compassion in a different way. I think that those kind of events that we do fairly regularly, those events, as we talk about racial justice and racism that's embedded within ourselves and within our communities, as well as the welfare simulations where we talk about experiencing what it's like to live in poverty, and we talk about classism, and all of those issues overlap. But as distinct events, they help us to focus on those specific issues. And I remember coming away from a welfare simulation, actually from several welfare simulations that I helped to facilitate, coming away from, and just as background on what a welfare simulation is, it's a three, and we call them now poverty simulations, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Poverty
yeah.
simulations, sorry. There are 3-hour simulations where participants kind of play a game, essentially, where they're assigned a role and they have a certain amount of money and they have certain family situation and work situation, and they have to interact in this kind of workshop setup where there are volunteers playing roles as the banker and the grocer and the food aid person and the child care center and the employer.
And all this is based, this isn't just somebody sitting in an office making it up. It was based on the real lives of people living in poverty, started in Missouri, and saying, this is what our lives are really like, and helping build that empathy.
Yeah, and then it's interactive for the participants. So they actually have to take the little money they have and go to each table that is supposed to be the different institutions in their community, and they're supposed to survive a day, basically, on the income of a person living in poverty, living in low-income, low-wage job. And things come up along the way in the simulation that can change their fate for better or worse, just like it does in life. And it's a short period of time, but after the simulation, I remember hearing students, especially the students who participated, the young people, hearing their reflections and also reading their reflections in the mm-hmm. surveys afterwards. And their responses shocked me in a lot of ways because I didn't realize how much they might learn in a short simulation like that. But there were many young people who said they had no idea. It had not even crossed their minds that it might be like this for someone.
And I think you talked about there's been a little bit of conversation about the relationship between our sort of broad-based awareness education programs and then the specific, we want affordable housing on this site stuff. And I think that's like, the welfare simulation has been a good tool to help lay a foundation of understanding. So one of the things that really comes through the simulation is everywhere you go, you've got to turn in a transit pass that reflects either what you're paying in gas or what you've got to get the transit. And a lot of people didn't realize what a barrier transportation can be for people who are living in poverty. Well, then fast forward to last year when we were part of the More Buses campaign, that building that base of understanding and compassion and awareness made it easier. So when we were going back to people in our core list who said, you know, we could say, this is an issue. And they weren't starting from scratch. They had already had some little bit of experience with it to say, oh, yeah, I remember the simulation. I get it how if you, you know, that transportation is a tremendous barrier.
Yeah. Yeah, and I get how all of those issues are connected now, because if the childcare center is closed on the day that I'm supposed to be getting to the welfare office, or, and then I can't get there, and then my transportation pass, you know, has expired, they got through the simulation how all of the issues are really connected, and that support on all of those issues can make a difference, including transportation and affordable childcare and affordable housing and a lot of issues that ICPJ advocates for came through.
The other piece where I see that fitting in, right? So I've been spending a lot of time lately thinking about what's happening with Ferguson and Baltimore and Cleveland and Oral Ross. Like the you know, it's pick up the paper and choose the police involved abuse of the day. And you mentioned the book group, and I think that's been one of those things where it helps to provide a deeper analysis. We were just talking with Ahmed Rahman, whose mom was born in Ann Arbor, and remembers when 4th Avenue by the co-op was the black business district, mm-hmm. and he can't, you know, I think Rose's is the only black-owned business in that neighborhood now. And so I keep, you know, having that analysis to say, you know, understand that when, helping people understand that when the suburbs were built, they were built with racially exclusive covenants so that black people couldn't move in there. And then as those are the areas that have appreciated in wealth, who's getting the wealth, who isn't? Look at Washtenaw County, 9 of the top 10 jobs that are growing don't pay enough to feed a family on. You know, when we take that back to police relations, we could have the best police and law enforcement agencies in the world. And I hope, and we're trying, we're working on it, we need to. But if they're still policing this level of deep inequality, it's going to be, I say it's putting a Band-Aid on a turd, excuse me, putting frosting on a turd.
It paints the picture, though.
You know, so, if people are only looking at the police and body cams and training, which we need to look at that, it's necessary but insufficient. And doing things like the Racial Justice Book Group or our movie series with the Ypsilanti Library helps build a group of people that have that deeper analysis so that we can say, yes, let's look at our policing, and it's part of a broader picture.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's actually something else that I was thinking about that I appreciate about ICPJ is the deeper analysis that I think we take the time for, that we cultivate with members at our events, and that we look at the shades of gray, look at the nuances in a lot of newsletter articles. I'm impressed by staff's writing, and also by a lot of our volunteer members writing, board members, and how they'll really be examining issues thoughtfully. It's an opportunity for people to dig a little bit deeper into all the nuance behind the social issues that we're dealing with, and to think about resolution from all of those aspects.
So if I could circle back for a little bit, you talked about when you were hired, it sounded like there was a question mark around the interfaith piece.
Oh, yeah. I could talk about that.
But now what I hear from you now is the personal, the spiritual growth and your own faith and spiritual journey is now very present in your life. What was that change like for you?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it's a really important question for me, because it was significant in my experience with ICPJ. I came into ICPJ actually at that point in my life. I was considering myself an atheist, and I felt a little bit uncomfortable signing on to an organization that was interfaith, and wasn't even sure if you all found out if I was an atheist, if I would be hired. So of course that's silly, and you know, there wasn't like a question in the interview about what I believed and didn't believe, but I found I was at kind of a dark place in my life in terms of my connectedness spiritually, and I knew that, and I was missing something. And I entered into ICPJ at that time, and although I was a little fearful of that, being exposed or being, you know, constantly surrounded by this faith piece or by the spirituality piece, because I was resisting it for a lot of reasons from my own past, I found through my exposure, constant exposure to people who were speaking about their religious values and speaking about their spiritual lives, in relation to social justice issues and just as because the people that we were surrounded with at ICPJ are vocal about their beliefs. I found that that exposure was absolutely necessary for me, and another part of why I feel like I was meant to work there. That exposure gave me, first of all, a respect for these different approaches. And I institutionalized religion at that point for me was a dark place because of my own experience with institutionalized religion. And once I experienced it through other people's eyes and saw their personal experiences with that, with their spirituality, whatever it was, I took that in and I grew through it and I learned to respect different viewpoints, and it took me down a path of exploring deeper what I did believe, not just what I was rejecting and what I was afraid of experiencing again, but it helped me to search for the things that I felt like I, with my own connection to my own spirit. And I did, and I actually, it was in 2009, so a year after I started at ICPJ, and this is more personal, but I had my first personal spiritual awakening, and that I think was really cultivated in part by my work with ICPJ. And that changed my perspective. It gave me a sense of lightness, of connectedness, of oneness, and it, kind of from a mystical perspective, which is sort of my perspective, it was totally transformative. And I still lived in my body and was my same self and was my same person. But I, that was a transformation for me and an opening of my heart. And there are a lot of things that went into that, but I think ICPJ was a part of it.
So this tension that you described walking into it as coming in as an atheist into an interfaith organization is something, as you know, we wrestle with. On the one, you know, for me, being interfaith means whether your faith is in Jesus, or it means you light candles on Shabbat, or it means you pray towards Mecca five times a day, or you've got faith, you're an atheist who has faith that a better world is possible. For me, that's mm-hmm. all interfaith.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of people do walk into ICPJ or wonder if they should walk into ICPJ as to wondering whether or not this is the place for them.
Well, and I have a comment about that. Yeah, and actually, I've explored that a lot because I've been in all these different, I've stood in all these shoes in a lot of different, I was baptized Catholic. I was you know, an atheist. I was agnostic. I now consider myself a mystic, but I also have roots in Buddhism. And so, like, I have a lot, I've worn a lot of those shoes. I feel like for me, so somebody asked me once when I mentioned to them, this was years ago, that I was identified as an atheist. They said, an atheist from what? Because so many people, and this is not true for everyone, but so many people identify as an atheist because they are rejecting what they had been taught, because they had grown up with something that didn't feel right. And that was true for me. And so I was an atheist in my mind because I rejected this notion of this particular way I was taught about spirituality. And it was so off-putting and destructive to me personally that I rejected all religion, you know. And so my atheism was about the structure of religion in the ways that I understood it, in the ways that the humans I had interacted with mm-hmm. understood it. And it was kind of a basic distrust of religion. And so coming into any organization that said it was about faith or people of faith, I had a distrust in that idea of faith. So there was a little bit of tension for me there. But I also know a fair number of people in my own family who consider themselves atheists, who actually are more similar to me than dissimilar from me at this point, where really it's their values and my values align. We actually have the same kind of sense about the universe and about spirituality, but it's just called something else. And I have friends who are humanists mm-hmm. who say that they're atheists as well, and we share much more in common than not. So even though I don't call myself that anymore, I certainly have felt over the years like there's absolutely a place at the table, I mean, in my mind and I think as an organization, for anybody on, you know, any human, for mm-hmm. anybody who cares about social justice and shares some of the core values of justice, of compassion, that is coming from a deeper place. It doesn't matter what you call it to me.
So you mentioned as you're getting started, and I had forgotten about this until we sat down, that you'd been involved with some of our anti-racist stuff. I remember mm-hmm. being at the Ann Arbor Community Center when Laura Spencer, who was the education director at First UU, was doing these anti-racist cookbook activities. And so you've seen through your time before you've been with ICBJ, mm-hmm. well at ICBJ, so what after ICBJ, mm-hmm. a variety of things on that, which is back to what you're saying about the personal transformation. A lot of these things. What do you think have been some of the most, what's been really powerful? What have you seen been most transformative with that? And like, if there's like anecdotes of like, I remember this happened, what are some of those?
So just the first sense I have about that is when I went to the anti-racist cookbook discussion, which was the cookbook, if I think I remember it right, was kind of like a, it's like an outline of things that you
like
can do to
like
challenge.
Group activities.
Yes, group activities to challenge racism in your own life, to challenge racism systemically. And I was so interested in that coming from, I had been helping out with an organization, the School of Social Work, as well as a co-leader for the Social Welfare Action Alliance. And we had been involved in the, what was it called, the Jenna Six? There were six, I think they were young black men who were arrested. I can't remember the story now, but it was in like 2007. And it, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's similar. It was along racial line. There were a lot of questions about whether it was race-based kind of persecution. And we had been really active on that. And I was really surprised to find a community group that was doing mm-hmm. the same thing. When you're a student, you're kind of immersed in the student world. And I was so excited to find that there was a community group that was committed to working on anti-racism. And working on identifying personal privilege. I mean, mm-hmm. that's something that I had never even considered until I went into the School of Social Work. I made it through 4 years of college, never even identifying white privilege. And so for me to see that that was happening beyond academia, which obviously mm-hmm. it is, but since I had only been introduced to it there. And I lived in the world for many years before mm-hmm. that. I had really just never come across it. I had kind of been sheltered from it, I guess. And so to see an organization doing that was important to me and one of the things that drew me to ICPJ. And then, but I worked for, I think it was 2 or 3 years, directly as a staff person for the Racial Justice, Racial and Economic Justice Task Force. And what stands out to me about that group were the individuals who were involved, the core team of individuals, which was a diverse group in terms of race, but also really diverse in terms of the way they approached things and their religious backgrounds and beliefs. But the feeling I have about that group when I think about them is just this sense of love. They were this the group that had come together, that stayed together for a long time, that had a real passion and a love to affect change on this issue, and are all leaders, I think, in our community at doing that in their own ways. And so being a part of that group for me was transformative because I learned a lot through their own expertise and their own paths. And then working with them to organize was an education for me. How do we approach this community that is racially divided, that is segregated? How do we approach it in terms of dealing with issues of racial injustice? And we made mistakes along the way. I remember making a mistake of 24-year-old young white woman from Ann Arbor. And I thought it'd be a great idea to have one of our racial justice events at the Ypsilanti High School. Like, I was just going to have that event there and then invite all of our contacts. And I just remember looking back on that, really no one came. I think we had a few people in attendance, and the next time we did it better, and it was smarter. But I remember I kind of led that effort, and I learned a lot through that group's reflections and through my own that I needed to have, you know, real connection. I needed to access the connections of our community with beyond the little bubble of Ann Arbor that I personally was more connected to. And it felt arrogant. It felt not like it was done well for me to organize to show up in our neighbor community without having contacted some of the leaders in that community about doing racial justice work together and partnering. So after that event, and that was for our Unnatural Causes series where we were talking about disparities in healthcare, racial and economic disparities in healthcare and access to affordable healthcare. But then the next time we did that, we did connect. I mean, we connected with partners. We had many co-sponsors. And I was a young organizer and obviously still learning, and I was trying to figure things out, but I learned through that group, and they were supportive and helpful about it, about the importance of, you know, walking into a community and asking what would be useful, asking if we can be partners, asking how we can share this effort that we're both committed to. And then, you know, other showings in that film series, the Unnatural Causes film series, were much more positive. And I think the message got out in a way that we wanted it to. But it was a learning experience about that.
So you also organized the crap walk?
Yeah. So. Oh, yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I organized the crop walk 2 or 3 years. I can't remember exactly. And that, the crop hunger walk is our annual fundraising walk to raise funds to fight hunger, both locally and internationally. And our we partner with, and again, you know, it's partnering with local organizations that do really good work in our community to address hunger, both preventatively and to relieve hunger for people within our own community and local communities nearby. And so we 25% of the proceeds from crop go to the go to local organizations, and 75% go into international hunger relief work. So I felt like that was a huge organizing effort. It was kind of intense and overwhelming the first year I did it, because again, I was a new organizer. I was trying to learn how to do real community organizing, not just what I was reading in school, like Saul Alinsky. It wasn't exactly the same thing. So I was trying to learn.
So all the books in social work
school
didn't quite get it.
Yeah, that was not that helpful. So, I mean, it's different on the ground. It's very different. And so I was trying to learn again through community, through the people who've been doing this for a long time, mm-hmm. and the crop hunger team is about 10 individuals, volunteers, and who have done this for many years. And they really led me through it.
And I think generally one of the things that has been a real strength for ICBJ has been, when I came in, I had a similar thing. I'd done campus organizing, I'd done a little bit of national organizing, but I'd never done local organizing. But I had the support community, because I had the people who knew the Latin America issue, who knew the racial justice issue, who had those relationships,
yep.
and were the... you know, they gave me that starting place. I wasn't alone.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And actually, they led me. I mean, they led the Crop Hunger Walk that year, and I just freaked out about it. I was the one who felt the responsibility, and they made it happen. So they, and it's an awesome team, and they're still doing it, and raising a lot of money every year to fight hunger. And that work has really expanded, and now there's this whole local hunger, local food effort theme year that's going on with ICPJ. So the crop walk for me, the things that I really loved about it were that it brought together our most diverse and largest group of people of any event throughout the year. It was often 500 people, maybe 350 to 500 over the years. It varied.
It's the advantage of just doing that eyeball.
Yeah. And it was families. Because of the nature of the event taking place on a Sunday afternoon, generally allowed for a lot of families to come out. And it was family friendly. It was a walk. That we, you know, beautiful day in September, we could go for a walk outside and raise funds for hunger. And also, it was educational in a small way. We tried to always include an educational component so that the young people there and the you know, everybody there, anybody who was part of our event was able to learn something about how to advocate for hunger, advocate against hunger, how to share with, we had kids' resources, how to share with children some issues about hunger.
I don't know if this is a year you were organizing or not, but one of the things I remember the climate change group doing was, you know, because there's this huge connection between climate and hunger, both because the food we eat in the United States has a tremendous climate footprint, and climate change really threatens people's livelihoods. So we did the little Burma shave poems at each of the watering stops. So people you didn't have to stop. You didn't have to slow down your walk to do it, but it was this little touch about here's why you're doing makes a difference, and here's how it connects to other parts so that you can make a difference beyond just this day of the walk.
Yeah. And it was so simple. It was a very clever idea. It was incorporating the educational part into the walk. People didn't have to stop and get a worksheet about it. It was learning as you go.
But people love their worksheets.
And they do love their worksheets and taking things home. But that event always felt so positive. There was a lot of positive energy. It was the people who'd been working with ICPJ for 40 years and brand new people every year who would raise their hands and say they'd never come before. So it had a really good unifying kind of energy.
We were at our fundraising breakfast on Wednesday, and our closing speaker was County Commissioner Andy LaBarre. And I remember meeting Andy LaBarre 12 years? Anyway, just after I got started, he was working with Representative Dingell's office and lobbying him on School of the Americas, Latin America stuff. But what I didn't realize until that Wednesday was his first involvement with ICBJ was when he was like 7 years old and he walked in the crop walk.
Oh, that's so
and
funny.
And his was one of the pictures that they, you know, when we had a daily paper, they took his picture and put it in the newspaper. So, you know, I guess he got his taste for public service then.
Through the crop walk. And that's hilarious because he was at my daughter's Young Fives orientation night the other night. So he must have a child or my daughter's age. Yeah. And I remember lobbying him. Like when he worked for Dingell.
Yeah.
I remember going to the office and lobbying with him. It all comes full circle.
Yeah, why don't you say a little bit about Fort Benning?
Okay. So I got to work with the Latin America Task Force for a few of the years that I was on staff with ICBJ.
And now you had a background, a connection to Latin America before you came here, right?
Right. So I had spent several months in the Dominican Republic before I went to grad school and had returned there to serve at an orphanage. Working with the kids there, I had returned a few other times after that. So I felt really connected to the Dominican Republic and to the people there. And I was excited to be working with the Latin America Task Force, which did a lot of social justice advocacy for, not for the Dominican Republic directly, although actually I think once there was some work on the DR, but for that culture, for the people of Latin America. So I felt some affinity. And I really, again, love the group of volunteers who work on that issue. They're so committed and passionate and so knowledgeable about the topic that I felt like I had an education just serving with them. Through my being a staff person for that group, I was able to go as the staff person for two trips to Fort Benning, Georgia, to the School of the Americas training facility there, military training facility there. And you can probably give a better short description of the School of the Americas than I can, if you want to give two sentences.
So actually, before I was with ICBJ, that was part of my background too, is as a campus organizer, helping organize carpools from Grinnell College in Iowa down to this protest of the School of the Americas, which had been a military training facility for Latin America military personnel. So we just had the beatification of Oscar Romero, and he was assassinated by somebody who's trained at the School of the Americas. And when you looked, especially during the 80s, the civil wars in Latin America and Central America, seeing so many of the people who were committing the massacres, committing the atrocities, we, the United States, were training them. So you look at what was happening, and we had culpability there, and so trying to shut down this military training facility has become a rallying point for people who are pushing for human rights and more just policies throughout the hemisphere.
Yeah, symbolically and literally.
Right.
It's a symbolic effort, but also literally we do want it shut down. And so going, and I didn't really know much about Fort Benning at all when I had started, but going down for me was really personally enriching. It was an opportunity to be in workshops with people from throughout the U.S. and throughout Latin America who had come with a passion for acting in solidarity with one another to change the U.S. foreign policy toward Latin America and to affect change in Latin America in countries where people didn't have opportunity or people were experiencing oppression over years and years. And so I learned a lot of new things. I also, as a young person, hearing from longtime activists, from older generations of people who had been working on this, gave me a sense of the history of it. So I learned a lot through that. And then just being connected to this, the power of a movement of people. When you're, you know, in a small community working for social justice with the number of activists that we have connected with ICPJ, it's really helpful, I think, to take a team of students down to Fort Benning and experience the, you know, thousands of people marching together in an effort for social justice. That kind of reignites this belief that there is energy out there that is all of trying to affect change. We're all doing it in different places, different cities, in different ways, but we're all acting together.
So the culmination of the vigil is this solemn funeral procession where everybody lines up with grave markers as cantors read the names of people who've been killed by the School of America's graduates, and it's the thousands. It goes on for hours, and after every name, the people chant back presente to call the people's memories to present. They're not forgotten. They're still here, and they're with us calling for justice. What was your first experience being part of that procession?
Yeah, even as you say it, I get a little... It's very emotionally powerful for me. And there were pictures of the dead all over the gates as well. So as you walked by, you saw their faces. And many of us were holding posters with faces of the of those who had been murdered. And there were children, there were babies, there were older folks, there were women, there were men, there were, you know, all people. And so I remember crying a lot during that march and being so moved. And then, you know, just that source, just connecting me at the source with the with my humanity, with these other people who were not, who I didn't know, who I lived so far from, and who I felt such love for. And I felt so deeply moved to act on their behalf and to protect others from that kind of fate. And it felt, I remember looking at the poster, it was when my daughter was a baby and I left her for the first time for this trip, and I was like maybe 8 months old. And I remember looking at one of the posters of a baby who had been killed and just breaking down because she was my daughter. And it's a really powerful way to experience what it really means to be involved in this work. It's personal. It is not just an idea of philosophy. It's a personal thing.
You talked about some of the inner work around compassion, and I remember being on the trip 1 year with Ann Elder, who's one of the farmers of the community farm of Ann Arbor, and we've done farm tours back when we did our land, food, and justice out to her place. But, you know, after hours of the presentes, it can be hard to stay present, but I just remember Annie sitting on the pavement and just still being present for it. And I remember 1 year... trying to stay present too, learning from her example. And there's a local singer, Joe Riley, and he has a song, Infinite Heart. And the refrain is, the room in your heart is infinite. There's no limit to what can fit inside it. If love is what you give, love is what you get. And so just using that as like what kept me centered to try to be emotionally present as the names were read.
That's beautiful.
Any final thoughts you want to share?
Yeah, I guess it was. It felt like a gift to me to just reflect a little bit on my path with ICBJ. I worked at ICBJ for 6 years and left about a year and a half ago to stay home with my two little girls. And just looking back on it reminds me how much I learned, how much I think I contributed, but really more how much I got through just being a part of that community, how it really was transformative for me to just be a part of ICBJ.